Blog Talk Radio. The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.
Hi, I'm Jenny.
Hi, I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life.
Welcome to A Shamanic Life with your host, John Carosella. On today's program, our featured guest is Jenny Seek, an intuitive dream counselor and maker of sacred empowered jewelry. John will also speak with Karen Armstrong, founder of the Shamanic Life online community. Later in the show, John will talk with the multi-talented Nicholas Breeze Wood, editor of Sacred Hoop magazine, shamanic practitioner, and musician. In spirit, muse, and song, we'll hear some of his beautiful music. Also on today's program, visionary artist Annette Wagner joins John for part two of The Vision Plan, a business plan from the heart. Christine Hagelin shares A Tale from the Road about her spiritual encounter with the artichoke. And Gina Carosella will share The Sensory Experience, a deep dive into the world of the senses. We're not just doing shamanism, we're living it. Come along with us. It's A Shamanic Life.
Hi, I'm John Carosella. This is A Shamanic Life, and I'm here with Karen Armstrong, founder of Shamanic Life online community. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, John. It's great to be alive and to be here.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to be doing this show. So this is our third show, and I'm having fun.
You and me both.
Yeah. Yeah. So so what's been going on for you lately?
Well, I have gone from excitement to a funk to excitement to a funk, and I've hired some really great, compassionate people in my life to help me start expressing myself more so that I can be a bigger presence in the Shamanic Life online community than just the founder and the promoter of others.
Mm, that's good.
Yeah, and to give people permission to start sharing their work.
I'm liking what's happening with Shamanic Life on a couple of different fronts. And one of the things that's cool is that Shamanic Life is bringing people together in interesting ways. And in fact, our guest today on the show for Spirit, Muse, and Song is Nicholas Breeze Wood, who I did not even know was a musician. Is one of the founders of Shamanic Life, right?
And, yeah, he's one of the founders.
And he's the editor of Sacred Hoop magazine. Right? And I thought, oh, Nicholas Breeze Wood, he's the editor of Sacred Hoop magazine. And suddenly it turns out he's got like four CDs.
Yeah, he's multi-talented. And what was so fascinating for me is he is almost my twin.
Oh, really?
He's such a great sacred brother, sacred shamanic brother, way over on the other side of the pond, and he was born less than 24 hours after me.
Is he as goofy as you are?
Yeah, he's goofier.
Well, we're going to find out.
I think he's as goofy, and that's probably why it's been hard for me to pin him down.
Well, yeah, and I know. Listen, putting together that magazine is not a small endeavor, right? It's a big job.
It's not, and you know what he's doing? He's taking it digital.
Yeah, I that's a good thing.
Yes, he's teaching himself and his team at sacredhoop.org how to take this magazine digital so that we can access it anywhere we are.
Yeah, that'll be great. And easier to share, easier to pick up, and a lot less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for him, so that's good.
And
also on the show today, we have Jenny Seek.
Jenny, go.
I looked at, of course, I had the chance to talk to and interview Jenny, but then she updated her Facebook profile photos and stuff, and she is such a character. She looks like she's so full of happy and ready to burst out laughing and enjoy life. It's a wonderful thing.
I know it is. and I've, you know, my humor can be all over the place, and you know, it's Jenny looks so happy all the time. And just the other night, it was late at night, and I was, you know, I do Facebook late at night, and somebody that we know and love posted on Facebook, "What do you think of moody people?" And what I did, because you've taught me to do this, right, I Googled moody, right?
Right.
And everything but moody and the definition of moody people came up, right? Like moody credit reporting, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I just wrote, well, I think you need to clarify what you mean the definition of moody is, right? And there must have been 25 posts.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
And I totally got sidestepped, and I finally went, calm down, y'all. Google moody and see what you get. And so it put everybody in their tracks, and they finally Googled moody because, you know, there was this, oh, happy people. I really am frightened of happy people. If they're happy all the time, there must be something wrong because they're not really in touch with their feelings, blah, 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 blah. And I just thought what was so interesting is that we're all so human, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And being happy and being authentically happy is really a gift.
Yeah.
Right?
And something you cultivate, right?
And something that you cultivate. I think that you know as well as I know that there were some times that we showed up for work in our way past, and we had to put on the happy face.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
We had to,
yeah.
Okay, I'm on.
Yeah.
I want to kick some butts, but I'm on.
And that's not really authentic. No, it's not. Well, one thing I like about our community is, and in the shamanic way of being in general, actually, is you can ask simple and apparently obvious questions and get a really different kind of deep, insightful set of answers. You know, no question is too obvious because there's a lot of assumptions we make about the way we exist in the world that just aren't true.
I agree. That's why I started writing more.
Mm-hmm.
I am actually really putting myself out there, and I have been playing this game with myself for the last couple, since 2011 were my first blog posts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been playing this game with myself. Oh, I have to take a writing class. Oh, I have to do this. Oh, I have to do that. It's not perfect. I have to have somebody edit. I have to do this. I have to do that. And it kept me from writing and expressing. And then I kept wondering these last 6 months, 8 months, why are you in this funk? Well, it was because I'm not expressing myself. I'm not dancing.
Yeah.
I'm not painting.
Yeah.
I'm not writing. I mean, I'm drumming. I'm rhyming. I'm doing everything right. I'm chanting, but I'm still in this funk.
Yeah. Well, you know, the truth is, I think I was kind of in a similar space and realized that when I'm making music, either singing or composing music, it's so healthy for me because it's a way to express myself that is organic, right? And it's not purposeful. It's not constructed. It's not designed to be productive. It's, you know, on my Convergence show, which aired March 17th, I talk about bearing fruit versus flowering. And, you know, bearing fruit is something that we all like because it's the harvest, but you got to flower before you bear fruit. And flowering isn't about being productive. It's about being vulnerable.
Amen.
Yeah. So
amen.
Let's get that vulnerability, you know, into gear, folks, because that's where we create opportunity for amazing things to happen.
Exactly. And, you know, that brings something that's very real for me, John, because since we've gone live with this radio show, it is really challenging me and it's pushing me to keep remembering who I am as an expressive being.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than doing all the things that are expected of me.
Yep.
Like mathematics. you should embrace math because math is in everything. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay. Well, we'll embrace that when I'm 70.
Okay. Well, it's a good plan.
But yeah, I was inspired to go buy a microphone other than this wonderful headset because I want to start singing into the microphone and I want to hear myself in the iPad so that I can just write what my soul is expressing. What does that sound mean to me?
Yeah.
And who knows? Who knows what will come out of it?
That's exactly it. When you flower, you have no idea what's going to come out of it.
Right. So I'll have the little microphone with the tripod. I'll have the paints out, right? And every time I do a couple of brush strokes, I'll be singing and then I'll be writing. I mean, why not?
Well.
Why not be not the absent-minded professor, but the absent-minded artist?
Well, yeah, the wantonly expressive artist.
Yes, the wantonly expressive artist.
That's great. Great. All right. Well, I think for now that'll keep us belted in for the rest of the show,
and
we'll have a chance to get back together in about 2 weeks. Yeah.
Great.
All right.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. On with the show.
Bye.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com. Or, like us on Facebook.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. With me today is Jenny Seek. Jenny is the proprietor of Inner Voice Intuitive, which offers a heart-centered approach that helps clients follow their path more deeply, clearly, and readily. As a practicing intuitive tarot reader, intuitive practitioner, Jungian-focused counselor, and shamanic practitioner, Jenny offers her intuitive gifts to help you discover your unique soul path by helping you learn to recognize your higher self. Jenny also has a business called Sacred Bracelets, where she offers commission designs for her clientele designed and developed using her intuitive connections. I'm sure we're going to hear about that and more. Welcome to the show, Jenny, and let's get started. Let me ask you this. How did you? What brought you into the shamanic path in general, and how long ago was that?
Sure. Well, I think that when we're small children, we are just by nature very shamanic in our orientation. We're very much between the worlds. We really, really seem to understand that the heart and the mind work together in tandem and that they are fueled by the creative process. And I think as we age, we start to lose that awareness because we focus so much on externals, things we have to do and things like that. And so that numinous experience, that transcendent experience, that's our birthright for everyone, we kind of miss out on.
So do you recall experiences from when you were a little kid?
Absolutely. I grew up in a home where I just didn't have the best fit with my family of origin, and I would have very, very vivid, lucid dreams from the time that I was a very tiny child that would confuse me a lot because, you know, when you're really small, it's hard to know what's grounded, what's present in the outside world versus what's present in our inner world. I had a dream at, I guess it was probably around age 7, where I was basically running around this castle, and there was this huge giant that was that usurped the size of the castle. So it was basically wearing this little castle, and I was kind of edging my way around the bulk of the giant around the floorboards, trying to, like, get out. And he picked me up, and he looked at me, and he dropped me. And before that, I had all these nightmares. I had a lot of dreams that were very, very scary for me. And when I had that dream, I started to have this ability to be able to wake myself up out of dreams. Because when he dropped me, I fell through this swirling green kind of sea of O's. And after I did that, I had the ability to be able to wake myself up out of these nightmares and out of these dreams. Now, I saw him when I was very, very young as being kind of a foreboding character, but I actually wrote a thesis about that dream experience and realized as an adult that he really offered me autonomy and creativity and adventure and the ability to kind of use my imagination in a positive way as opposed to having it overwhelm me or scare me. So he was really a huge gift.
What do you think the significance of the O, the Sea of O's was?
I think that, well, as I fell through the Sea of O's, I felt like I was rising up out of the dream. And before I had had that dream, I felt really overwhelmed by my dream life when I was a little child. I felt really overburdened and not safe there. And so I think it was a way for me to maneuver in my own life this ability to rise up out of something. It's like instead of he dropped me, but I got to swim through them at my own rate and at my own, you know, my own way, and to kind of get grounded as I did that.
So let's fast forward a little bit from your childhood experience of dreams to realizing that this was a calling and beginning to do the work. What was the transition there?
Well, the transition there was really that I've been very, very self-motivated from a young age, and I've seen things in a pretty unique way. And so sometimes I felt kind of isolated and kind of alone. And sometimes I felt very lucky to have the kind of vision and connection that I do. And so I guess I had several jobs that were not a good fit for me. And I spent some time on unemployment doing what I think everyone should do when they're on unemployment, which isn't go running out looking for another job, but is to take the time to figure out and do the inner work about where the next opportunity is and what the goodness of fit is like for that. So I spent pretty much a summer doing that. I spent a lot of time on my back porch meditating, working with my chakras, doing extensive dream work. And that's when I started listening to my calling, what Jung calls your callings, what Joseph Campbell calls following your bliss. Instead of trying to find a job, really figuring out what the universe was asking me to do. And I got very, very clear indications that I was supposed to do readings for people, intuitive readings for people, and that I was supposed to make this jewelry that I had started making for myself. I had some more nightmare dreams. I've always had tended to have a lot of nightmare dreams. And I would go to this one land in this one set of dreams where I would be flying over this what I can just call a Russian forest. It felt like a thick conifer Russian forest. And I dropped down into there, and I would have all of these squabbles with these animals that spoke to me. And they would always try to get me into these really complicated conversations, which there's a parallel there certainly in my family. And I didn't know what I was doing there or why I was there. So I designed this bracelet for myself to bridge the work of the dream into the work of the topside world. And for me, that's that active imagination component that Jung talks about. And so when I did that, I designed a bracelet for myself to kind of work with the energy of that Russian forest. And someone saw it on my wrist and said, well, what is that? And I said, oh, it's this bracelet I made to work with some dream work, and I'm doing this dream work with people. And I did a dream bracelet for her, and I started out small. And then I started doing this intuitive jewelry for lots of people to kind of work with the images that come to them and to kind of create the visions that they're incubating, that they're imagining now in their lives. Because we know that the more that we can stay in that heart-centered spiritual place of manifestation, the more on a quantum level our bodies start to respond to that, and then the universe responds to that as well. So that's really been what the jewelry work has been about, and that's a lot about working with clients too. That's a lot of the kind of work I do with clients. A lot of times when people do psychotherapy, they focus a lot on things that have happened in the past or going into the trauma. And I work really hard to help the client figure out what those visions, what those images are that hold energy for them so that they can hold energy around maybe setting some parameters or boundaries around some of the things that have happened in the past, healing them, of course, but then moving into the place where really they're working in this new territory, which is with those images and with that energy, that calling, that inner calling that they're drawing toward themselves all the time.
Well, I have to say, the bracelets are very beautiful and very captivating.
Oh, thanks.
And that's at sacredbracelets.net, is that right?
Yeah, sacredbracelets.com. And then I also have a Facebook page as well called Sacred Bracelet.
So tell me how a bracelet emerges for you.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, I usually work in cooperation with the client. I'll work with the energy, and I'll notice any affirmations, any inspirations, any inclinations that I get while I'm making the design for people. Some people really need energies that are very even and very steady, more like even numbers. Some people really need to have spontaneous energy and see what comes next. With those people, I'll just really listen to my inspiration and move through the piece that way. Some people, there are certain colors that they need to work with energetically in terms of chakras. Sometimes I'll do earth, air, fire, water work in the bracelets for clients to work with. So it really varies. I've had dream images come to me around it, all sorts of things. It is as vast as your imagination.
Fascinating. So do you work mostly alone? I mean, do you work in conjunction with anybody else?
No, I really don't. I'm actually getting ready to start a women's group, and that will be more of group work. I mean, I will be the facilitator, but I'm really looking forward to that more co-creative kind of a process, and that's called Women at the Edge of the Woods. But I have worked pretty much solitary, so yeah.
Right, so you don't have to worry too much about people, or you haven't had to encounter folks who, in your working environment, look at your shamanic disposition and wonder about?
You know, I've really worked hard in my life to get those people energetically to not have so much power over me, I guess. And I came from an environment where I was very, very concerned about what people thought about me, and I don't think I was very much myself for a long time. And so part of the work I've been doing is figuring out who are my clients, what kind of jobs do I want to take. Like, I spend a lot of time imagining or visualizing, you know, I don't want people who are going to be really, really demanding about their designs and things like that. I want people who are going to trust the energy and let the energy flow with the idea that I'm going to listen to them. So I really set my intention around the kind of experiences that I want to draw toward me.
And did you, how long did that take for you to discern what that energy, what kind of energy, what kind of clients you wanted to have, and then to sort of set that intention firmly inside of you so that it could radiate out? How long was that process?
Well, that's an ongoing process for sure. You know, we all as human beings are human, and we move, you know, forward, and then we move back, and we work out our karmic lessons that way. But certainly that process of getting clear has had stages. When I did readings at different festivals and things like that, I remember having a lot of clients who would really drain me a lot and expect me to carry a lot of the energy of things. And I remember doing this meditation the night before, and I set my intention, and I drew different colored stones, and I charged them under the moonlight, and I asked for sunny clients, you know, I asked for women who were had sunshine inside, who had their own life already. And that year I drew a ton of women like that, and I was really inspired by their stories. And so that's the first time I really realized that I could shape that energy and I could set that intention. And now I help some of my clients do that, too. A lot of what I work on with clients is boundary work, because a lot of people who do this kind of work feel like they have to work with everyone, and they, you know, their energy starts to get depleted and that sort of thing. So.
Mm. Well, that's very interesting, and it's, yeah, I imagine that that was a pretty eye-opening experience for you in terms of understanding the practical nature of the power that was available to you.
Absolutely, and the responsibility that comes with it. You know, I mean, it can be such a small thing to notice energetically where your own energy is around something and to know if you have the energy to do the work and to know what you need to do to refuel and renew yourself. And that's not a message that we're taught in the culture.
No, we're taught take the hill at any cost kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly.
That can be pretty draining for all of us, but in particular when you're doing spirit work, it's...
people who go deep, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think we generally have a really tough time nurturing caregivers in our culture.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, and you know, we don't really have good models for that, and we don't have... we're not taught how to do that for ourselves particularly well, and, you know, that's why so many nurses get to the place of burnout, and it's really sad because it's a calling, you know.
Yes.
But if you drain the vessel to the point where it's damaged, it's hard, you know, it's hard to keep doing it.
Yes, absolutely. And that leads me into the whole why I started doing the work on my own, because so many of the systems we've created can be so dysfunctional around needs of self-care, around needs of people being themselves in that environment, you know, and you can just feel like you're on this, I don't know, straight shot to hell or something. Like, I remember my parents saying, well, you know, you just have to do whatever you have to do for your career, you know. I mean, you have to totally give up yourself pretty much.
Yeah,
subjugate
yourself to some other
agenda.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's not so good. It's very interesting. Over the last, you know, I've interacted with probably three or four people, four or five people this week, and there appears to be a message in the wind, and I don't know if it's just for me particularly, but my attention certainly is being drawn to it. And I think maybe it's part of the new energies that are coming through. And it's just what you've said. It's be yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a conversation for my Convergence radio show with a guy who shared that for a lot of indigenous peoples, it's not just encouraged for you to be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's seen as a moral obligation to be yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, you know, that's so foreign to the way we look at the world. You know, it's like being yourself is a moral obligation because that is the way, that's the way you will be happiest and therefore be the least irritating to those around you who have to live with you, you know.
Right.
And B, of course, the other side of that is that you will also be the most fulfilled and passionate about your daily walk. Because you will be living your truth. And
absolutely.
You know, how did we miss that?
Yeah. That's a lot of the reasons why I started to doing the work the way that I do it, because it had to work for me. And I even got told a lot of times in work environments that I was in my early years that there was something wrong with that. Like that if I had my own inner life, if I had my own interests outside of the context of whatever company I was working for, I was doing something disloyal. Like I bumped up against that energy a lot, and I was like, I had to do a lot of inner work to figure out that wasn't true. You know, that was somebody else's stuff. That was not what was really going on here, that it was okay to have my own identity, my own ideas, my own opinions, And that was a dysfunctional environment, that was a toxic place to be. And I didn't have good barometers for figuring that out.
And I think most of us are taught exactly that. It's like,
yes,
the job is the destiny, right? The job,
yes,
is the quest. And that doesn't leave room for us to be ourselves, particularly.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
most of the time, the jobs that we take are not really aligned with who we are, and and most of the time, the work, because of that, the work environments that we're in are full of people who are not doing their best work, and they're not being themselves, and
yes,
they're not the nicest people to be around because of it.
Yes.
Real brokenness in our system that creates a lot of trauma and a lot of suffering, I think.
And I think when I was younger, I spent a lot of time pointing out the brokenness. And you, of course, you can't do that. If you point out the brokenness in a dysfunctional environment, you're going to be the one who scapegoated, because it's just the way the story plays out. And it took me a long time to not take that personally and to figure out that, you don't give that kind of information to someone who can't elevate themselves or change their environment, because it'll make them mad, you know?
Well, because they feel helpless, and
exactly.
Well, that's not nobody wants to feel helpless, so then they just get mad.
No, right, exactly.
So on that note, let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the techniques that you use in your work. I know you do dream work, and you work with animal totems, and so on and so forth. So we'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back.
Life comes at you pretty fast, and you're doing the best you can. But maybe you could use a little help. Are you looking for answers or feeling a little stuck? Something nagging you that you and your doctor can't quite explain? Or maybe you're looking to enhance your game or improve your performance at work? Consider a visit with John Carosella at The Shamanist. Whether you need a little guidance or even a little miracle, John can help. Visit in person or connect by phone or Skype. Schedule a rune, oracle, or tarot reading. Experience a shamanic counseling session, or a Reju Keto or shamanic healing session for body and soul. Experience more of your world and yourself. The sky's the limit when you tap into the realities that are just beyond our sight. Mention this ad and receive a special gift when you book your first session with John. For a little help, or maybe a little miracle, theshamanist.com.
So I guess it's for you it started with dreams.
Yes.
So tell me how you invested yourself in developing a discipline around dream work and how it's changed your life.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I would have to say that probably every single bit of transformational work that I ever did and that I ever created started in a dream in some way, and that's been a pattern for a long, long time. And I would say, I would have a lot of dreams about bugs, and I would equate bugs with air energy, which had to do with if there's some sort of nuclear disaster or whatever, the only thing that will survive are bugs, and there are lots of them. So this whole kind of motif or idea that these energies could work in tandem with each other really, really well, it bugged me, right? And we know from the way that complex works that when something bugs us a lot, we have a lot of energy that we haven't explored. And so I would have these dreams where I would have these bugs like all over the place, and I would have to jump over stair landings that were filled with centipedes and things like that, like, many-legged bugs. And so I had to move energetically from the place of being reaction oriented to being an observer, which you think about the whole fight or flight idea. And so I had to be an observer. And so I would go into those dreams differently once I realized that I was being bugged, that there were all of these nightmares that I didn't know what to do with. And I would go into the place of the observer instead of the dream ego. And when I did that, I got really curious about the bugs, you know, and I noticed that they were beautiful. I mean, some of them had these jeweled kind of shiny, shimmery shells, and that there was a beauty there. And when I did that, I shifted the energy in myself. So when I would encounter people who had that more kind of group-oriented energy, I before would be afraid and have a lot of labels about them and try to stay away from them. But energetically, we know that we always need, to a certain extent, those things, you know, that shadow component. We always need to get up against that shadow a little bit more and explore it a little bit more. And so I found myself being curious and intrigued, and I needed more of that air energy, more of that energy of joining together and working together on my own terms. And so that was a wonderful, amazing shift. That's when I realized that the dream, that you can really shift the energy from the dream, and the work that you do in the dream will create amazing transformations in your waking life once you release that energy. And that was probably the first time. Then I worked with a seal totem a lot. The first shamanic journey work that I ever did, seal showed up. And didn't know why or anything. And then I read Ted Andrews' books. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, seal is all about the power of lucid dreaming. And seal is all about, seals are pinnipeds, so they don't have external ears. They only have an inner ear, which represented the intuition. And I was blown away because there couldn't be a better descriptor of me than someone who was interested in lucid dreaming and connected with their intuition. I mean, and so I was like, wow, you know, that can't be random.
Mm-hmm.
And then seal showed up in my world, in my dreams, as a little baby. And it was peeing all over the place, so like releasing this energy and not in control and this sort of thing. And then just seal showed up again later on, and I was holding this baby seal, and it bared its teeth at me. So to me, that represented developing a stronger ego. So seal just kept coming back in different ways. And then when I went to do my master's, I had a dream. I was on this pile of pillows, really, really high. And this would be about 2 years before I went into the program I was in, and I was teetering on this pile of pillows, like 3 miles in the air, which is all about being in this place where you're safe, but you're disconnected, you're above, you're elevated above everybody else. And I was sitting there, and I realized that I could sit there really, really still, but if I moved, I would fall. And I was like, well, I don't care. I want to fall. I know this is a dream. I should fall. So I allowed myself to fall, and I fell into this beautiful seal cove, and there were all these seals all around. Well, when I got to Santa Barbara for my program, my master's program, I walked down the beach, and I walked into that very seal cove that was in my dream. It looked exactly like it. So, like, and that was 2 years prior. So, like, if I followed the very transcendent energies in the dream, the numinous energies in the dream, and trust them, they show up in my waking life, and they always have. And I think other people can do that too. I think our tendency, though, is to focus on the symbol way too literally. So we go into the dream and we think that it has to show up with sprinkles on a Tuesday because that's what it looked in the dream. But really it's about this felt sense experience. It's about when it feels energetically like the same thing, like there's been an energetic match. And your dreams will never take you astray if you do it that way, I don't think.
Well, I think it's interesting because it took you a little while, for example, with the insects, right? It took you a little while to get past the nightmarish fear part.
Very much so.
to then settle into the real message and medicine that was being offered, right? And that's the energetic match you're looking for, right?
Yes, very much
right?
So.
It's not the you don't want to. It's not the energetic. It's not the fear. Well, though, I suppose one might have been the case that you experienced an energetic match to the fear state in the dream when you were a part of a crowd or asked to participate in a community or group operation.
Yes, absolutely. And I had to work energetically with myself.
Right. So those energetic matches work both ways, but obviously we're looking for the medicine, not the trauma.
Yes, exactly. And I think, too, when you work with clients, it's the same way. There's this tendency, you know, clients want to unburden themselves, so they want to give you all the details of all the trauma, but that can re-traumatize people. There's a really wonderful book by Peter Levine called Waking the Tiger, which is about shamanic work with people who have experienced traumas. And that work is a lot about noticing what empowered them or got them to feel like they could get through the trauma. So a lot of times it's a connection with nature or the richness of a musical piece that's being played, so that that dissociative tendency and need in a traumatic experience can be the thing that creates the bridge that allows the person to heal. And I've definitely found that for myself.
So do you use that kind of, do you use singing or toning or anything like that in that way in your practice?
Not in my practice so much. I would love to. I've never had anyone say they want to do that or be in the place to do that, but I do chakra meditations with people where I go through the meditation and work with them to come up with affirmations. And I've done a lot of toning myself.
Mm. Okay. How about the elements? Do you work with the elements?
Yeah, a lot, actually. When I was working on my master's degree, we were given these case studies of different potential clients. And I remember not only because I'm very, very auditory, I would sing parts of the different pieces of the treatment plan that I was creating, but I also equated them with the elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And so instead of looking at psychopathology from a pathological model or an evidence-based model, I looked at it more from the perspective of how the elements show up, how earth, air, fire, and water show up in the psyche, and what needs to be balanced. And that was a great way for me to remember these different case studies so that I could prepare for this test, because I don't think I could have done it in the traditional way. It just didn't speak to me in the same way. It didn't stick, I guess, is what I would say.
So in a way, you exercised a different learning and memory circuit by mapping analytical experience onto elemental story.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
It worked. And that's all that mattered.
So
the practical piece.
So it sounds like the singing practice with the chakras and the elemental practice are like handy innovative tools that you have developed. How can folks like me or others in our audience manage to use these things themselves?
Absolutely. The best thing to do is just notice energetically what speaks to you as you're singing and allow yourself to create rhymes and rhythms and what I call zipper songs. You know, if there's a particular line, change the words and notice energetically what happens in your body when you do. If you get a release of energy, if you get a constriction of energy, when we align with numinous kinds of energies and connect with our own inner divinity, we have this great barometer for how to get there, how to reach that that state. And that inner barometer is our own experiencing. So start singing, start playing with words, and don't, you know, get that inner critic out of there. It's not about if the words sound right, if the music is beautiful. It is about the process. And the more that you can play with those kinds of words and phrases and rhymes, that's playing. I mean, and that connects us with that inner divinity quicker than anything else.
And so, I mean, this sounds a little odd, but as a question, but what is the goal?
The goal is to get what feels like an energetic match, what feels like a shift in you, so that so that you go in and you ask a question and you wait till you feel a shift in energy. You wait till you feel something feels complete. So you're really sensing your own inner inner energies, your own emotions, you know. I mean, you know how you've had those experiences where, you know, those mornings where, I don't know, you walk somewhere and it's just perfect and everything's so beautiful and so wonderful, and you feel this relief, this endorphin energy and this wonderful sense of peace and calm. So you can know what that barometer is for yourself by just noticing what it is you're feeling. We make it really complicated and put a lot of words to it and, you know, talk about acetylcholine and all this stuff, but really it just is how good you feel, how connected you feel, and that's about noticing what you're feeling.
Right. Well, I think that's another story that is emerging, at least around me. And that is the fundamental truth and essential value of sensing what one feels, feeling one's feelings, right? As opposed to analyzing one's feelings. Very different things, right? You know, I have had a long history of feeling something and then launching into a deep and complex analysis of that feeling and why I'm feeling it, as opposed to staying with the feeling and continuing to feel it.
Yes, absolutely. And we're really reinforced by our culture to go into that analytical space and to overanalyze and to overthink instead of staying with the feeling and the experience and the processing aspect of it. But a really great way to know when you're in that complex, what Jung calls that complex material, is a lot of times there's a lot of words that come up with it. I mean, a lot of, like, extraneous words, like word salad around it. And there's a lot of tendency to feel not grounded. And that's a great way to know that you're starting to go out into that kind of, you know, hyperspace of analyzing or needing to analyze.
Right. Okay. All right. So we're getting close to the end of our conversation, but I wanted to ask just a couple of other questions.
Sure.
Can you identify something, one of your bigger challenges or significant learning experiences as you've come into this work and developed your practice?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest learning challenge that I've had is that you really can do it on your own terms, like that, you know, and that it isn't about, and actually just recently, because I had a sickness just recently, and my tendency is to go into overdrive and to think that I have to work super hard, and if I don't, nothing will get done, but there's this amazing ability that we have to set our intention and to imagine an outcome. And usually when we can imagine, when I can imagine that outcome without needing to be able to manifest it, I know that I'm on my way to things changing. And so a lot of the work that I've done is about holding that energy and it just, you know, in random moments of time and imagining those different things coming to fruition, like, you know, a client finding you and wanting to do a bracelet around this or something that you've really been wanting and just holding the curiosity about how that will happen and feeling like you're getting closer to that energetic match, so that synchronistic experience where you go, ah, this is popping up again. This energy is popping up again. It's getting ready to manifest. There's a tendency to get into that place where you're like, oh, my gosh, I have to manifest this. And then there's a whole bunch of people who reinforce the idea that if you don't manifest it, you're not really doing the work, which is all just ridiculous. I mean, you just have to get away from that kind of stringency about the imaginative process because it will shut down in when that happens.
Yeah, I think something that you said that is really essential is that you need to That getting to a place where you can imagine it manifesting, and imagine the value of it manifesting to you without feeling needy.
Yes, that's huge. That's huge.
So I've taken to say instead of saying things like I want or I need,
mm-hmm.
I now say things like I will be delighted when.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Right? Because
yeah.
I looked through my vocabulary and portfolio of concepts of what is it that I'm actually seeking, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately the most convenient place for me to drop all this stuff is into delight. Right?
Yes.
Because do I really need it? Do I really need it? I probably don't really need it. I probably want it, but I mean, do I really want to be wanting something? You know, I'd rather be delighted by my life. Right?
Exactly. And curious and excited. And yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the one of the ones that I use. Okay. So, and then another question. Do you have top five? Can you share one of your top five experiences or one of your most powerful experiences that has come to you as you've done your work either for yourself or with clients that's really smacked you and changed your life?
I
know you shared some already. You know, you shared the seeing the Seal Cove. That could well be on your top five list.
Yeah. Oh well. I do. One of the experiences that changed my life and in a big way. A lot of my work has been to move away from my parental voices and move away from the energy of my family of origin to a certain extent. And I guess it was in 2008, I was planning on going on this trip when I finished my thesis work. I was planning on going abroad, and I thought I had funds for it, and I had miscalculated my funds. And so I wasn't going to get to take this amazing trip that I thought I was going to get to take. And I already regrouped, and I was like, okay, I'll go to Niches, and I'll go for a long weekend in a cabin kind of thing, and I'll just put off this other trip, which I had always wanted to go to Greece. Well, I went to visit my family to go see for my birthday, a belated birthday present, and I was going to go see Lorena McKinnitt, who's this wonderful singer who sings songs from different countries and different traditions. And I was going through my parents' computer images. They had gone on a trip to Turkey, and it was then that I realized that I didn't really want to go to Greece. I really wanted to go to Turkey. and I was like, I want to go to Turkey. And it kind of sunk in, and I was like, well, before I die, I want to go to Turkey. Well, I've learned in my own life, as soon as I say before I die, something is going to manifest really, really quick. Because it always does. But so I was thinking like all the whole weekend that I was there, well, how can I get to Turkey? How can I get to Turkey? Well, I'll create a savings account for Turkey. If I have to use the money for something else, that's fine, but I'll call it the Turkey account. I'll start to make it real in my world. I looked at Globus and found out that if I had 9 people who would go to Turkey with me, the 10th me could get the plane fare free. So I was like, just spinning in my mind, how am I going to make this happen? How am I going to make this dream a reality? Well, we went to see Lorena McKinnitt that night, and Lorena McKinnitt started talking about this amazing trip to Turkey. And I figured out from the order of the places she was describing that she had been on the same trip to Turkey that my parents had been on, because their photos were in the same order of the places that she was describing. So
wow.
I was like, oh my gosh. So to me, that was like, okay, Turkey feels a lot closer. And yet nothing had happened, right, really, in the external world, but boy, Turkey felt close. So I got home to Columbus, where I live, and I started asking people, have you been to Turkey? Do you know anyone who's been to Turkey? And turned out the woman I was living with, her next-door neighbor had been to Turkey, and she showed me her pictures. And then I was at this women's group, and I said, has anybody here been to Turkey? And they said, actually, there's a group going in December, and that was just a month away, and we need two more people to go. And I said, oh, well, you know, I probably can't afford it, just figuring that I probably couldn't. And they said, well, look into it, because it's really, really not, you know, that cost prohibitive. You really should look into it. And so a month and a half after deciding I wanted to go to Turkey, I got to go on a 10-day trip to Turkey, got a flight inside of Turkey, and was hosted by all of these wonderful people. It was with an organization called Bakiad, which is an organization that creates tolerance between Muslims and Christians. And that was how I was able to go on this trip. And we were just wined and dined. We stayed in 4-star hotels, and
wow,
they fed us wonderful meals. I mean, the trip was, it was hand-stamped for me.
And so, very cool.
And if I had said what my family of origin would have said, which is, oh, well, you know, that's not going to happen, and that's not possible, and, well, you know, you really have to look at your finances. I mean, if I had come at it with the, you know, the whole, well, this can't be because it won't fit for me kind of thing, I never would have found that. I never would have asked those questions. I would have set it aside and said, well, this is something for another lifetime or 10 years down the road. I wouldn't have kept the dream alive in me in the way that I did.
That's beautiful. That's a great story. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. So is there anything, any last thoughts you would like to share with our audience before we go?
Just to trust your visions, trust them no matter how offbeat they are, how irrelevant they may seem, no matter how much support, that's really what I want to say, no matter how much external support you have for your visions, really trust your visions, trust your dreams, trust your numinous content, and find support for in your corner of the world for those dreams. It's really important that you have someone to dream with as well. So that's what I would say.
Great, great. And folks want to get to know more about you or your work, where shall we direct them?
To innervoiceintuitive.com and to Inner Voice Intuitive Hour on Blog Talk and to Sacred Bracelets.
Great. All right, Jenny, thank you so much for spending time with us on A Shamanic Life, and we hope to hear more from you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, John. It was really a pleasure.
Okay, take care.
It was delightful.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is John Carosella, host of A Shamanic Life and Convergence on Firefly Willows, LIVE. Every once in a while, we get a bonus Sunday. That is, a fifth Sunday in a month. That gives us a chance to do something extra special. Join us for the fifth Sunday of March for a special call-in show about careers. We'll have Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite High C. Lutmers on hand with his insightful tarot skills and special guest Ivan Teams, career coach and author. Ivan has led sessions and worked individually with thousands to rediscover their passion and follow a path of joy in their lives and careers. Join us on March 31st at 10:30 a.m. Pacific. Get the reading that could change your life. March 31st at 10:30 a.m. Pacific time, right here on Firefly Willows LIVE.
Welcome to Tales from the Road. Tales from the Road is where we share stories and experiences from our shamanic journeys and the impacts they have on our way of living. In this segment, my guest is Christine Hagelin, whom I met as part of a 12-month plant medicine study group led by Daniel Four of the Earth Medicine Alliance and of AncestralMedicine.org. In her previous career, Christine was a biology teacher at a community college, so her understanding of plants is based in solid science. Now, though, she's getting into contact with the natural world through a more spiritual perspective. Welcome, Christine.
Oh, thank you, John.
So we just finished our third monthly meeting, right, Christine?
Yes.
And let's share, if you would, what drew you to participate in Daniel's 12-month plant medicine program?
Well, I had participated in his earth medicine training the last 3 years,
Okay.
So I wanted to keep in contact with him in a training perspective. And I was excited and had a sort of a different idea because I, in recent years, had connected a lot with plants, I thought. So it's been sort of interesting to connect to, initially, a domestic plant, artichoke. So I didn't, I thought we were going to just go out and check out plants in nature, and so this has been good.
Right. So, as you mentioned, our first assignment with Daniel was to pick a domesticated food plant and to get to know it as a spirit and to get to know the ancient people who first brought it out of the wild and into domestication.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty cool thing to do. I picked peppers, and you picked...
Artichoke.
You picked artichoke.
Right.
And this month we did a journey to the spirit of the plant, seeking an honoring ritual.
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience on that journey? Tell us your tale from the road.
All right. So I initially, when I contacted the spirit of artichoke, contacted a very male-like, wild energy. And when I actually was connecting to the domesticators, it was either sort of a wild desert environment, and they were hungry, so they were going to check it out. My ancestors were from Northern European, so that wasn't a plant that was wild in their environment. So the last journey, I contacted again this wild energy. And it was, or he was really sort of telling me, I want my space. I don't want to be crowded. I want to take up my full space. And
have you grown artichokes? Have you in your own garden or anything?
No.
Yeah. Well, my experience of the artichoke as a plant is that it does want its space.
Yeah.
It's big. I mean, it's easily 5 feet and tall at least, right?
Wow.
And can be taller and at least as big around with these big, broad leaves that come up from the bottom that are really spiky.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they stick right out. Like,
yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have actually two plants that I bought that I am going to plant. And, in fact, they're telling me, please plant me today. No, I've been in this pot too long. I got to get some space. So, yes, I am going to do that. And I have contacted a wild artichoke out in the field, guy named Farrell Kevin. I went on a hike with him, and the wild artichoke is in the field is wow. I mean, it's got its spines. It's in its protective mode. Very different than the domesticated form that has, I think, been bred to have less thorns, less spikes,
and maybe more flowers.
Oh, potentially, yeah, right,
yeah. So this energy, this wild male take up space energy that you connected to with the artichoke. Did it have anything else to share with you?
Certainly, don't take my protection away, because if you take my protection away, I'm really susceptible to being invaded by other little predators that want to eat me.
Mm.
So I do need to have some protection.
All right. So given that that was the journey and the message that you received about the plant, nature of the plant, what do you make of that? How is that going to impact your life And is there, what is its impact for you?
Well, certainly to take up my space, to not shrink, to really, you know, fill up that space with all of myself. And I think a good portion of my life, I've been very accommodating to the people around me, wanting to, you know, sort of checking out, if in order to be liked, I really need to do this or I need to do that. And so it's again, I've been working on this for a while, but certainly I had, I was really quite surprised that this message came from Artichoke, because I had thought that I just sort of randomly picked this plant, and obviously I had not.
So the message from the Artichoke is about as far from the message of a shrinking violet as you might have imagined, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and you know, I one thing that I was thinking about too is that, you know, there is that balance of like taking up like too much space, and actually, you know, overshadowing other plants or other beings. So it's, you know, it is that balance of you know, that right place of. Of being, you know, stepping into your full self, but not overstepping. And I mean, I don't think that would be my issue, but I know, just reading about Artichoke, that, you know, it can, out in the wild, it can start to take over space of other plants. So.
Well, you know, what comes to mind for me is, you know, right place, the right place for success. You know, the artichoke clearly is a successful plant, right? Mm. It being that big and that commanding of space,
yeah,
is a successful strategy,
mm-hmm.
and it exists in balance with the environment in which that kind of behavior is appropriate. So, like in the desert, where it's hard to grow anyway,
yes.
You know, if you want to give yourself room to really do it,
there's plenty of space.
There's plenty of space, right? So
yeah.
It's like, you know, you want to be artichoke-like when it's appropriate to be artichoke-like, right? That also means that I guess the thing that just keeps coming back to me is that it's not wrong to be artichoke-like, right? It's just it's an honorable, successful strategy.
Yeah.
And so for folks who are used to not being, you know, not taking up their full space, there's a lesson here that, hey, wait a minute, that's actually an okay thing to do.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's surprising to me that, okay, you're from an artichoke, it's telling me, fill up your space, be who you are, you know, step into it.
Well, that's wonderful. So, you think this will change your life a little bit here and there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You might do things like be on the radio. And
Yeah, right. Certainly. Yeah, I mean, even just doing this is stepping up, you know, putting myself out there. And, you know, already even in this last week, I've had some more than a few lessons. I've actually even seen once where I was shrinking again, and caught myself, you know, which was good. Caught myself as I was doing that and going, wait a minute, wow, no, this is a pattern that I don't want to continue with. So it's working me. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So. For our listeners, if you would like to catch up with Christine and learn a little bit more about artichoke medicine with her or along with her, You can reach her at cnature@astound.net. That's the letter C and the word nature, cnature@astound.net. Anything else you want to share with us before we go, Christine?
Well, really be mindful of the plants you eat. They have a lot of medicine.
All right, Christine, thanks so much for joining us for Tales from the Road.
Great. Thanks, John.
And we'll be back.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm John Carosella, host of A Shamanic Life and Convergence on Firefly Willows, LIVE. I'd like to invite you to a new monthly study series starting in April, Taking Up the Runes, Living Amidst Their Power. We live in an American-dominated world with a worldview we inherited from the British, who were, in turn, powerfully shaped by the Norse. And the power of the Norse is the power of the runes. I invite you to join me in a 12-month program to intimately study the runes. Understanding the runes, I believe, will illuminate the deeply hidden power structures and assumptions that form our contemporary world. In these times of radical change, I believe understanding the runes is essential to the successful and peaceful transformation of our world. Join me. Learn more by sending an email to me at jc@theshamanist.com. More information will be available online shortly, but for the moment, indicate your interest via email. Our plan is to meet once a month for a Sunday afternoon and understand these archetypal powers. Make no mistake, we are surrounded by them. Seeing them clearly will help us wisely incorporate them as allies instead of being at their mercy. If you're interested in learning more, email me at jc@theshamanist.com. Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. With me is Annette Wagner, a visionary artist and shamanic practitioner, and she's with me for the second in a series on the vision plan. Last week, we talked about the vision plan in general. Annette, what are we talking about this week?
So this week, we're going to talk about the first panel of the vision plan, which is all about passion and purpose.
Okay. Now, let's set for our listeners, let's reset the context on the vision plan. What is it all about? What are we trying to accomplish?
A vision plan is, if you will, a business plan from your heart. It's a process of engaging your right brain and your left brain, using visioning and creative practices, and most of all, intention, to really connect deep inside of yourself and ask some very deep questions and create a plan that begins to manifest that purpose out into the world.
And so this is for just, I guess, it's fundamentally, it's purpose and joy. We're looking for how to live our joy through this plan.
Yes. And the interesting thing is, it's about living our joy, but it's something that can be done for little tiny projects. It can be, what is my life purpose? How do I get my book written? How do I start a new business? How do I engage my spiritual practice? You can use a vision plan for anything.
And your experience of people doing the vision plan, when they're done, what do they discover? What do they see? What have they accomplished?
Usually when they're done, they usually have a huge smile on their face, which is always very gratifying.
Yeah, that's great.
Because they can already feel it start to manifest. They can already start to feel this sense of, wow, I didn't know I was going to get these answers to these questions. And that really resonates, and that's really cool. And they fill up. They get filled up with this energy of connecting into their purpose, and they go out the door just laughing.
Delighted. That's
and,
great.
And full of joy.
Okay, so now today we're going to talk about your passion. Right?
Yes.
The first panel of the...
Yes, passion and purpose.
All right, and so how are you going to take us through that? Give us a preview of what we're going to talk about today.
So I'm going to start this little segment the same way I would start one of my workshops, is we are going to go through a little simple, what I call red thread ceremony, and then we're going to do a short visioning, and then we're going to talk about what we do with that, what we what we get in our vision and how we work with that when it comes back.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start.
All right. So the way I begin all of my creative sessions is one of the practices we call a red thread ceremony, which comes to me from my teacher, Shiloh Sophia McLeod. The red thread is present in all cultures around the world in some form or another, and it's a representation of the red thread of life. It's a representation of connection. It's one of the ways in which we set intention when I do my classes. So I actually have a red thread here on the table between John and I. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold a strand of it in my hands, and I'm going to ask John to close his eyes while I do this.
Okay.
And those of you out in the audience to just close your eyes for a second and take just one or two breaths to ground yourself. And as you do that and you think about this concept of passion and purpose, think about what intention might be bubbling up inside of you. Just one or two words of intention that you might want to hold this process of asking this question about passion and purpose with. And just take a breath or two and let the word or words just kind of bubble up inside of you. And when you have those words, tuck them into your heart and open your eyes. All right, and I'm holding the red thread in my hands and my word of intention. So usually when I do this in a workshop, I'll say my name and the intention and then pass the red thread to the next person. I'm Annette, and my intention for today is transformation. And then I'm going to hand the red thread to John.
Okay.
And he's going to hold on to a piece of it.
All right. My name is John, and my intention for today is sharing and community.
Aho. Now the red thread is going to go out to you in the audience and connect up with all of you, and then I'm going to bring it back, and as I'm bringing it back into my hands, I encourage all of you out there in the air listening to say your name and intention out loud. And what I'm doing is I'm tying the red thread into a circle of connection, if I can do that and be coordinated at the same time as John chuckles at me. Sometimes the thread cooperates more easily than other times. We're going to do this way. So once I have the thread in a circle, then what I usually do in class, which we won't be doing on the air, is I actually send around a pair of scissors, and we cut the thread between each of us. And that piece of thread, which today we're going to leave in a circle today to hold everyone on the air in connection with this,
right.
But we cut the red thread so each of us has a piece of it, and then we can use it in our art, we can tie it on our wrist, we can put it on our cowgirl boots,
right.
We can do whatever we want with it, but okay. it holds that intention for us.
Right.
So it's something you can use and put on your altar.
Very good.
So now that we're in red thread connection, I'm going to begin the visioning that we are going to do to ask this question about passion and purpose. So I encourage everyone who's listening to get comfortable. And before we actually start, there's one little housekeeping detail we have to do.
Okay.
We need to ask the critic to take a nap or go on a little vacation or to become a fly on the wall. And this is a key piece of doing any of these creative practices, because that voice of the critic is the one who says, "Why are you wasting your time on this? Don't you have something else to do?" And the critic is an important part of what we do, because the critic offers protection and the critic is counterbalances things. But sometimes in Western culture it gets a little out of whack. So what I like to do in class is I actually open the ceiling.
Okay.
And I get my rattle, and all together we shout at the ceiling and say, "Begone, critic! Begone!
Begone, critic! Begone! Begone! Begone!" Okay, everybody, open your ceilings and.
One, two, three.
Begone, critic.
Begone. And we rattle it, and we close up the ceiling, and the critic is taking a vacation.
Okay, great. All
now,
right, well, I feel good about that.
All right, now, get comfortable, close your eyes, and here we go. Take a deep breath and let it out slowly. Keep taking long, slow breaths as you center your awareness in your body. Feel your feet on the floor. Feel your hands resting in your lap. As you settle into your body, move your awareness into your heart. Feel your heart open and fill with light. Observe what color the light is. Feel the light surrounding you and holding you. As you look around you while you stand in the light, you see a path leading away from you. The path is mysterious and beckoning. You begin to walk down the path. As you walk, you see a structure off in the distance. As you near the structure, you realize it's a doorway. This is the doorway of possibilities. Walk up to the doorway and look at it. See if there are any symbols or images or words or colors on it. What shape is the doorway? Run your hand over the surface of the doorway. Take all of this into your heart and hold it. When you are ready, step through the doorway. Look around and observe the surroundings. You're in a different world now. As you look around, you sense someone nearby. It's as if they're waiting for you. You turn and take a step towards this person. This is your muse. Greet her. Take her hands in yours and look into her eyes. She is waiting for you. As you look into her eyes, share with her your intention in your heart. Ask her, "What is my purpose in this life? What is my passion? What am I called to do?" Speak with her for a moment and let her words and images and sounds and colors sink into your heart. When you are done speaking with her, look her once again in the eyes and thank her for her message and her gifts to you. Hold these messages and gifts in your heart. Know that you can come back here and visit whenever you need to. Step back through the doorway and follow the path back to your heart. As you come back into your heart, settle back into your body. Take a deep breath and gently open your eyes.
Okay, so we're back.
We're back. So now that we have gone on our journey, What I encourage people to do is to take a pencil or marker or crayon and a piece of paper and just draw and sketch the message and the gift and the words and the impressions of that journey. We're not yet quite creating our panel. We're just capturing.
Mm.
And don't worry about drawing skills or how something looks at this point. That's not part of the process. The part of the process is just to kind of capture it and get it on a piece of paper so that we bring it out of that world and into this world.
Now, one thing that I think was, there's two things that I wanted to note about the nature of the journey that you took us on. One was that you said that we could come back anytime, right? So, you know, I think this is an important thing to remind ourselves of, that we have the option of consulting these guiding resources frequently. You know, if we do it with intention and with heart, they don't get impatient, right? So we get to go back. If we didn't catch everything that we felt we needed to catch in this first trip, mm-hmm. we can go again.
Yeah.
And the other thing was that you invited us to ask three questions
mm-hmm.
of the Muse. And I have a question about that. I guess it depends on what our mission is, right? For a particular vision plan. If we have a very localized vision plan that we're
mm-hmm.
we're working with, we would ask a kind of a different kind of question. Or is that not true?
No, that is true. In fact, when I do this in class, I'll sometimes do a broader set of questions, or I'll encourage people to ask their own questions.
Okay.
And to simply go have a conversation with the Muse.
Right.
Because if I'm doing a vision plan that's about something small, like say just about creating a new, wholly new kind of workshop, say, that's a very different set of questions than I might do if I'm saying this is a vision plan for the rest of my life.
Right.
So, although what's interesting is the more you do this practice and the more you ask these questions, what happens is you start to see connections between your vision plans and how the bigger ones feed the smaller ones, and that they're all actually, it's like they all live in a circle. They're all connected, and they all feed each other.
They're all part of the same hologram.
Yes, exactly.
That's very interesting.
Yes, yes.
Cool.
So they also, I think, are stronger because they are connected like that. They have a much better manifestation rate, if you will.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
So, yes. So I asked the question. I asked three questions because just in my own shamanic practice, it's you always ask three times. Now, I don't always ask the same question three times, but I ask three times. But I also ask three different questions because one question may not resonate for someone.
Right.
And so I want to open the doorway so that people can come in whatever way resonates for them.
Right, right. Very good. Okay. So anything else for this segment?
Well, so one little piece of homework is, now that we have come back and drawn our message and our and our visioning, what I would normally do now is have folks actually start on the first panel of their vision plan, and to choose a symbol and a set of words, and to actually use watercolor paper and paints and start to actually build a vision plan. So that would be maybe the homework for our listeners to go off and to think about how they're actually going to create a piece of art around that.
And this is this first panel is, again, our passion.
Yes, it's what is your passion, or you can phrase it as what is my calling. And you might want to have a title at the top and have a symbol, and even you could even tell the story of what your passion or your calling is on the panel.
All right, great. And if you want to experience this face-to-face with Annette, which she is planning a workshop for?
Yes, March 23rd, Saturday, March 23rd, I am having a vision plan workshop in my studio in Mountain View, and there are still spaces available, and we will actually go through all eight panels.
Okay, all right. And again, the best way for folks to get to you is?
AnnetteWagnerArt.com.
Okay, all right. So thank you, Annette, so much for sharing this very special kind of work that you do with me and with the listeners to A Shamanic Life. And we'll be back next time with the next panel.
which is
Legend.
Legend. Okay, don't miss that. All right. So thanks again, Annette, for joining us, and we'll be right back.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi-C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi-C at tarotbyhic.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
Welcome back. I'm John Carasella, and this is A Shamanic Life. In our next segment, The Sensory Experience, we're joined by Gina Carasella. Gina is a writer and an intuitive crystal worker, and she's sharing her moments out in the world through the gift of her writing. So the sensory experience, this time, Gina's going to share her experience of lost pines at night. Welcome to the show, Gina.
Hi, thanks.
So what have you got for us today?
Well, Lost Pines at Night was an experience that came about because of the demolition of a house down the road from where I live. The home in question had had a half circle of beautiful, beautiful tall trees, and they had had several other large trees in the yard as well. And I always thought that it was one of the more attractive homes on our street because of the big, beautiful trees out front. They screened the house. It was really lovely and very distinct.
Those trees were they cedars?
I'm not sure if they were cedars or yew trees. I thought that they might be the English yews.
But they were really tall and
very
slender.
Tall column trees, basically.
Mm. And very dense.
And yes, very thick. And when the property changed hands, the new owners decided to renovate, and they took the house down and every tree on the property with it, which was very startling to see, and created both a very strong emotional reaction and also a very strong sensory reaction, because the entire yard was different. It was a big empty space where it had previously been a very full space. Mm-hmm. And in tearing down the tree and tearing down the house, it created a lot of dust, a lot of pollen released, and disturbed the ground. And the trees themselves were, you know, cut down and put through a chipper.
Yeah.
And that resulted in a great deal of, you know, dust in the air.
Right. Now, is there significance to the fact that you are sharing this experience of this loss when you experienced it at night? What's the night part?
Primarily it was the sense of emptiness from that space was much heavier at night.
Ah.
When I passed it during the day, it was jarring, it was glaring, but when I passed it at night, it was wrong.
Mm.
Because there was supposed to be presence to that space. There was supposed to be something there, and in the dark, that presence was no longer there, and it was very jarring, because you get familiar with territory, you get familiar with the way it feels to move through it, and to have that suddenly change at night when you're relying on things more than just your sight.
You're relying on something other than visual cues.
It becomes very, very difficult to respond to that sudden change of terrain.
Interesting.
Additionally, I find that night air tends to hold certain smells in a way that is different than daylight air. And so the scent associated with the disturbed earth and the wet dirt and the ground trees was much stronger at night.
So I imagine this experience was kind of sad and painful for you.
Yes, it was certainly melancholy. When I first realized that they were tearing the trees down, I didn't realize the extent to which they were going to clear the lot. And the loss of just the front rank of trees was emotional, and I was angry to see that they were gone and sad to understand that they had been taken out, and I had no idea that that change was coming. And then when I came back by later over the course of this project and realized that they had actually just clear-cut the lot, it was very upsetting.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, why don't you share that sensory experience with us?
Lost pines at night. An empty lot that was full 2 days before. The lingering presence, stronger than it ever was when the trees stood tall and proud, stretches out into the cool blackness all the way down the block. I loved those trees, deep green columns, casters of shadow and creators of mystery. They seemed a relic of another time, though they could not, in truth, have been that old. Now the trees are gone, and the house with them, and the life that was torn out with their roots and crushed with their branches lingers behind in the air. It is a wet smell, a green one. It mingles with damp, disturbed earth, and in the quiet stillness, it smells like a fresh grave. It clings to the back of my throat, a bright, choking zest, and carried on the chill air, caresses my skin like the touch of a ghost.
Is your heart a beacon filled with purpose, leading you forth on your path in passion and spirit, helping you live a life of wonder and joy? Join visionary artist Annette Wagner for an afternoon of intentional creativity, unearthing purpose and passion in your life in Garden of My Heart, Visioning Your Life. What is your calling? How will you take your work out into the world? Through this workshop, we engage our right and left brain and fully invest our dreams with intention. And our vision plan begins to manifest those dreams immediately in subtle and amazing ways. You'll be surprised. Create a business plan from the heart. Join Annette Wagner for Garden of My Heart, Visioning Your Life on Saturday, March 23rd from 10 to 5 in Mountain View, California. Register today at AnnetteWagnerArt.com under workshops. Your heart will thank you.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Up next is Spirit, Muse, and Song, where we select an artist and share their spiritually inspired music or performance art. For this program, our featured guest is Nicholas Breeze Wood. I know of Nick as the editor of the Sacred Hoop magazine, which you can find at www.sacredhoop.org. But I had no idea what a prolific musician he is, too. So Nick is a shamanic practitioner, in addition to his work on the magazine, and he also makes drums and a host of other ritual objects. He also describes himself as a stringophile, with a collection of about 50 stringed instruments. But then he also has a bunch of woodwinds and bagpipes and more, no doubt. So there's a lot about this man that is yet to be discovered. Let's listen to the song La Zeta from his album Ayonu.
Thank you.
So that was La Zeta from the album Ionu by Nicholas Breeze Wood. And we are privileged to have Nicholas online with us.
Hi.
So welcome, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So you have you're quite a character. let's just start with that and set the ground rules here. You do a whole bunch of different things. You're the editor of Sacred Hoop magazine.
Yes, I am.
That's and right. You make drums and
yes.
rattles, and you collect ancient antique instruments.
Well, I collect reproductions of antique instruments. The antique ones are a bit expensive.
Give us a postage stamp experience of what it's like to be you, and then I want to talk about your music.
Okay. Well, I mix kind of shamanic practice and music, and I suppose I have done for about the last 30 years. I guess my day job is shamanism, and music is my kind of hobby, for want of a better word.
It's a great passion. That puts you squarely on the opposite side of most people, where shamanism is not their day job.
No.
But that's what a shamanic life is about.
It's making things and doing the magazine and sort of doing bits of healing for people, and I do bits of teaching and stuff like that. So it's very much my day job, yeah.
That's fantastic. How did you find your way into it?
Oh, shamanism. I trained as a psychotherapist many, many years ago, and some of the stuff that I did was a little bit fringe, and it kind of led me into doing medicine wheel work. So I kind of got into shamanism more from medicine wheel. So that's kind of the short version.
Okay. All right. So let's touch on your music.
Okay.
How does your music come to you?
I've always had a kind of thing for music that's slightly trancey, that kind of puts me into an altered state a little bit. And I just get that kind of urge to play that kind of stuff. So it's music that has a kind of mesmeric quality to it. I really like that. I like the kind of North African stuff that has a mesmeric quality. And I like medieval music because some of that, although it kind of technically isn't mesmeric, it kind of does something to me. So I always feel a bit kind of altered stated when I'm kind of listening to medieval music.
Well, so. this La Zeta that we just heard is from a medieval troubadour's melody.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Tell us a little bit about
that melody from it's kind of improvisations on a melody from a troubadour from the south of France called Bernard de Ventadon, who died around about 1190. And it's a song which translated into English is about, it's a love song really, but the title is When I See the Lark Rising. And La Zeta is the word for lark. So it's not exactly the melody, but it's kind of playing around with the melody. And I can't remember what instrument I played then. I think it was a medieval lute of some sort, but I'm not 100% certain. I can't remember.
So, and how did you find the melody for this song from the 12th century?
Well, I don't read music, and so I've been around medieval music listening to it for a long, long time. So I've got a lot of recordings, and I played in groups and sort of jammed with other people as well. So I know the melodies fairly well off by heart now after all these years. So kind of what I do.
Well, so is that a song that was just... I mean, these medieval melodies, are they just passed down, or is there a repository somewhere?
No, they were written down. I mean, the troubadours were the proper troubadours sort of started around about 1080 and went to about 1300 in the south of France, and they were very, very popular at the time. And so their melodies, actually, most of the melodies haven't survived, but the poetry and some of the melodies were written down in books, and then they kind of spread over into the rest of Europe and influenced a great deal of European culture just afterwards. So they're preserved in that way.
Okay. And the troubadours, were they also the spiritual jesters and healers
of the day?
No, most of, well, not all of them were aristocrats. A lot of them were.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they. I mean, the first troubadour was Eleanor of Aquitaine's grandfather.
Oh, well.
So you can't get much kind of more exalted than that. Not all of them, but a lot of them were. It was very much a kind of aristocratic pastime. And, Bernard de Ventadon was actually a baker's son. So, you know, he wasn't an aristocrat. But he became the troubadour of Eleanor of Aquitaine. So he probably came to Britain when Eleanor became queen, marrying Henry II.
Wow.
So no, they weren't healers. They were, a lot of the songs are about love of different sorts. Some of it's very mystical, some of it less so. Some of it's very bawdy. very political songs, lots of songs about warmongering and how the barons are all fighting amongst each other, and exhortations to go on crusade and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, okay.
But they come out of the time of the Cathars. I mean, the Cathars were the sort of so-called heretical group of that area.
Yeah.
And troop culture was destroyed when the Cathars were because of the Albigensian Crusade. So there's probably some correlation, and certainly some of the troubadour families would have been great Cathar supporters.
Well, that's kind of what I was suspicious of, that there was some mystical connection that they carried through their music across the countryside.
Could it be? Certainly it's possible. And certainly some of the musical forms come from Arabic mystical poetry too, because the troubadour music's heavily influenced by Arabic music from the Moors in Spain. And the instruments all come from that kind of part of the world, too.
Yeah,
we didn't really have instruments in the West until we met the Arabs.
Yeah, well, it's a really fascinating time where the culture is mysteriously veiled in some way, because it wasn't particularly literate, and yet there was a lot of cross-cultural engagement.
Yes, that's right.
So
that's right.
It's kind of cool. And we're going to listen to a cut from your album, Shine. We're going to listen to Water. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right. Some of the stuff that I do is quite influenced by kind of shamanic and mystical thoughts. And water comes from, I was listening to an anthropologist talking about cave painting, and he was talking about how in cave painting, the marking of the animals or the patterns on the cave wall is a little bit creating a barrier. It's creating a portal between the spirit world, which is inside the rock, and the everyday, which is this side of the rock.
Mm.
So it's like making a doorway. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stayed with me, and the song isn't kind of too intellectual about that, but that's certainly the theme at the end of it, and the sort of the repeated refrain in it about letting the spirit through is around that. It's putting marks on different things so that the spirit comes through them.
Well, I think
so. That's kind of what it's about, but it's also drawing from the kind of North African trance sort of style of music that you get in Morocco with the noir players and people like that. So I really like that kind of very trancey sort of North African vibe. So that was an experiment in trying to get somewhere around that.
Well, I when I first listened to it, it was actually striking in its the transcendent, the gateway capacity, the doorway capacity that I felt, that I sensed in the music, was right in line with the lyrics and the
yes.
idea that these things are mutable. The veils can be thinned by intention.
Yes,
you know?
They can indeed. I think when you're kind of working in a trancey way, and I think a lot of that North African stuff is, especially. There's a whole kind of shamanic element in the music of Morocco. They use a bass lute, which is it's called a gimbra or a sintri, and they very much work. Although it's an Islamic tradition, they work with the jinn, the spirits of the desert, and they play this very mesmeric music in these all-night sort of healing sessions where the jinn come into the room and come into people. So I think trance can kind of potentially do that, and there are all these cultures around the world that actually use it very specifically like that. And I just love that sort of music, so you know, I'm trying to kind of get into that sort of feel with things sometimes.
Well, we're lucky to have you as a resource for us to tap into. So, Nick, if folks want to get a hold of some of your music or sample it, where should we direct them?
Oh, Bandcamp.
Yes, and it looks like it's nicholasbreezewood.bandcamp.com.
Yeah.
So let's listen to Water on our way out. Thanks, Nick, so much for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. mark on the skin, and the skin becomes water, and the surface of the water's where the spirit comes through. I make a mark in the skin, and the skin becomes water, and the surface of the water's where the spirit comes through.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Carosella. Please be sure to join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for the debut broadcast of our newest weekday show, Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Leisney. Evolve will broadcast every third Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m.